Well, it doesn't get any easier today in Leviticus. This chapter deals, chapter 18 deals primarily with human sexuality, what is expected of Israel in that regard, as opposed to the rest of the world during this time in history. And we read this entire chapter last week, so we're going to reread only a short section this week, just to refresh our memories. So please turn your Bibles to Leviticus chapter 18. Leviticus chapter 18. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it is page 130. 130 if you have a complete Jewish Bible. Leviticus chapter 18. We're going to read just a few verses. We're going to read 6 through 16. None of you is to approach anyone who is a close relative in order to have sexual relations. I am Adonai, your God. You are not to have sexual relations with your father. You are not to have sexual relations with your mother. She's your mother. You do not have sexual relations with her. You are not to have sexual relations with your father's wife. That's your father's prerogative. You're not to have sexual relations with your sister, the daughter of your father, or the daughter of your mother, whether born at home or elsewhere. Do not have sexual relations with them. You are not to have sexual relations with your son's daughter or your daughter's daughter. Do not have sexual relations with them, because their sexual disgrace will be your own. You are not to have sexual relations with your father's wife's daughter, born to your father. She's your sister. Do not have sexual relations with her. You are to have not to have sexual relations with your father's sister, because she is your father's close relative. You are not to have sexual relations with your mother's sister, because she is your mother's close relative. You are not to disgrace your father's brother by having sexual relations with his wife, because she is your aunt. You are not to have sexual relations with your daughter-in-law, because she is your son's wife. Do not have sexual relationship with her. You are not to have sexual relations with your brother's wife, because this is your brother's prerogative. Through verse 16, we are getting instructions on what constitutes what we call incest. A man having sexual relations with a woman who is too closely related, whether biological or familial, in any of these forbidden circumstances, is incest. Now, because the culture has changed so much over the centuries, and because these prohibitions and rules were being introduced into an ancient Middle Eastern society, we can kind of lose the point of what's being laid out here. It was less a matter of putting binders on a predatory man looking for a willing woman than it was about defining who a man could marry and who he could not. Who a man could father children with whom he could not. Bottom line, as much as anything, this has to do with setting boundaries around where a man can look for a wife. And in summary, we see that a man could not marry his own biological mother, even if his father died or he divorced her. He couldn't marry his stepmother, his father's wife, if his father died or he divorced her. The list continues with prohibitions against marrying his natural sister, his half-sister, even a stepsister. A man could not consider as his wife, his own son's daughter, a grandchild, nor that daughter's daughter, that is a female great-grandchild, still too close of a relationship. I think it's better if we kind of look at this chart of no-nos. I don't want to get too deep into this, but considering that marital relationships in the remainder of the Bible kind of revolves around this set of commandments, let's define a couple of technical terms. Cosanguineal and affinal. Cosanguineal and affinal. Now, basically, cosanguineal means one is closely related genealogically by blood. Affinal means that the relative has, by marriage, been joined to a particular family, and so there is no genealogical blood relationship, or if there is, it's in a very distant one. Now, from a legal standpoint, what has been set up here in Leviticus 18 are the rules as to what constitutes consanguineal relationship. And when the relationship is finally distant enough to be considered affinal. This is an important issue because back in Moses' day, it was desirable to marry a family member. So the question was just how distant of a family member was legally eligible to become a marriage partner. Marrying within the clan or the tribe was always promoted as a good thing, an important thing. A man marrying his cousin was seen as an almost ideal partnership. So just how close in blood relationship could one come and not violate God's laws about it? That's what Leviticus chapter 18 establishes. Now, verse 16 talks about a man not entering into relations with his brother's wife. The thing to understand is that in general, what is not being talked about here in this chapter is adultery. That's often a big mistake people make when they read this. This is not about adultery. There would be some other reason for these sexual relations to be occurring, and usually it had to do with marriage to that particular woman. But it's also a bit confusing in that once a man marries a woman, in some circumstances that woman's relatives become considered consanguineal relatives of the man, even though there is no actual blood relationship. That is because the Hebrew view was that marriage brought the man and the woman together as one flesh. That instruction to mankind dating all the way back to Genesis. And therefore, if that woman was previously married and she had children, those children were to be considered close blood relatives, even though technically they weren't, to their stepfather. So a man could not carry out a process whereby he married whereby he married and then this woman dies, or he divorced her and next marry her daughter, even if that daughter wasn't biologically his. This was because the Hebrew culture regarded that stepdaughter as just as much a blood relative as if she was biologically that man's own child. Now, I know this is detailed, it can get confusing, but Hebrew society was complex. The society of the Bible was complex. And these are things we need to understand, at least on some level, if we're going to deal with them throughout the Torah and the whole remainder of the Bible. One other rule to understand, in general, as far as the Old Testament era was concerned, men couldn't commit adultery. This was looked upon as a female-only crime. How you like that? I'm not going to have a vote, because I think I know how it'll go. A man having sexual relations out of wedlock was usually looked down upon, but it wasn't something one would necessarily be penalized for. Now, of course, a man whose wife cheated on him certainly wouldn't be happy about it. In fact, he might well kill the other man in an honor killing. Maybe kill his wife, too. And usually it was considered justifiable if he did it. Anyway, Jesus kind of straightened all that flawed thinking out once he started his ministry. Now, as for this verse 16 and a man not being able to marry his brother's wife, there is a major exception to this rule that we're taught that we're introduced to in Deuteronomy 25. If a man has a married brother, follow me. If a man has a married brother, that brother dies. If that dead brother's wife had not produced him an heir, a son yet, it became the duty of the surviving brother to marry her in order that she would produce children in the name of that deceased brother. This was considered critical in keeping intact Israelite family lines. And equally as important, the ancient belief was that in a man's offspring, his sons, that his life essence continued to exist after his own physical death. Let's read a little bit more of chapter 18 in Leviticus. Let's read 17 through 21. Chapter 18, 17 through 21. You are not to have sexual relations with both a woman and her daughter, nor are you to have sexual relations with her son's daughter or her daughter's daughter. They are close relatives of hers. It would be shameful. You are not to take a woman to be a rival with her sister and have sexual relations with her while her sister is still alive. You are not to approach a woman in order to have sexual relations with her when she's unclean from her time of nidah. You are not to go to bed with your neighbor's wife and thus become unclean with her. You are not to let any of your children be sacrificed to Molech, thereby profaning the name of your God. I am Adonai. Now in verses 17 and 18, we move from the issue of marriage to blood relatives to simply moral matters involving sex. For instance, a man should not marry or have sexual relations with both a woman and her daughter. This is referring to a woman who had that daughter with another husband. Nor with that woman's granddaughter. Nor, in verse 18, is a man to marry two or more sisters, having them both as wives at the same time. Now, before we get to the next section, which means all this stuff is going on, by the way, God doesn't issue hypothetical laws and commands. This stuff was happening. And before we get to the next section of Leviticus 18, let's pause momentarily and discuss something that many of you are probably already thinking. Didn't Abraham marry his own half-sister? How about Israel, Jacob, that great patriarch who married two sisters? Rachel and Leah. Well, certainly this occurred well before the time of Leviticus, yet we have to ask the question, did they do something wrong? Well, we have little choice but to accept that even if it wasn't God's ideal that they would not marry sisters or somebody so close in family bloodlines, it was God's general will to allow it at that time. I can't tell you why. I don't know. But neither am I going to allegorize and make up some flowery reason or defend God's choices. He did it. That's it. That's the end of it. The point is, much like it was with Noah, when after the flood he could eat meat, but he was prohibited before that great deluge, so it is with the definition of consanguineal or close relatives when it comes to marriage. A different dynamic emerged on Mount Sinai. Well, we move now even further into sexual matters that aren't about incest, but God says these things are immoral. They should not be done. And as we've already studied the state of impurity that a female enters when she's on her monthly cycle, I find it interesting that it is again brought up here, and it is lumped in not with unclean, but immoral. Not that the woman is immoral for having what is just a normal, natural bodily function, but that the man, the husband, is doing something immoral in God's eyes to have relations with his wife during that time. Next in verse 20 is the prohibition against a man engaging another man's wife in sexual relations. Actually, this verse is a little more explicit than what most translators have allowed. It literally says a man is not to place his seed into his neighbor's wife. It really means that the man is not to get this married woman pregnant. That's what it means. That's what it says. Besides the immorality of it all, the cultural reality was that children that got produced from these types of illicit affairs were looked down upon, they were shunned, they became outcasts, they suffered from it. Notice it also says that the male who does this thing is defiled right along with the woman. That is, both the male and the female are doing something wrong and they are both unclean from it. Okay. It's interesting how even the most pious of the Hebrews skipped over that part of the law and made it a tradition that it was only women who were doing anything wrong in this situation. The Jewish culture didn't appreciate it. When Jesus reminded the men of this hypocrisy and of their sinfulness when they had affairs with women other than their wives, but it was that woman that got in trouble if they got caught, not him. And then in verse 21, we have a command that doesn't seem to really fit in with all the rest. It is an order not to allow the Israelite children to be offered as human sacrifices to the Middle Eastern god Molech. Now, just a word here. For a long time it was thought that Leviticus had to have been written not sometime around the Exodus, but considerably later, because of the mention of this god Molech. All evidence was that the Canaanites didn't worship Molech before about the 7th century BC, about 600 years after the Exodus. But in the last few years, an altar was found that dates to the 14th century BC, just outside the city of Amman, Jordan. And lo and behold, buried underneath this altar were the skeletons of small children and infants. One could debate whether this was an altar dedicated specifically to Molech, but it was for certain an altar to a god, and we find all those skeletons. So it's no longer debatable that in what amounted to a section at that time of the land of Canaan, at the time of the Exodus, the child sacrifice was occurring among the Canaanites in the era of the Exodus. So let's read a little bit more now, Leviticus chapter 18. We're going to go from 22 to the end. You're not to go to bed with a man as with a woman. It's an abomination. You are not to have sexual relations with any kind of animal and thus become unclean with it, nor is any woman to present herself to an animal to have relations with it. It is a perversion. Do not make yourselves unclean by any of these things, because all the nations which I'm expelling ahead of you are defiled with them. The land has become unclean. That's why I'm punishing it. The land itself will vomit out its inhabitants. But you are to keep my laws and rulings and not engage in any of these disgusting practices, neither the citizen nor the foreigner living with you. For the people of the land have committed all of these abominations, and the land's now defiled. If you make the land unclean, it'll vomit you out too, just as it is vomiting out the nation that was there before you. For those who engage in any of these disgusting practices, whoever they may be, they will be cut off from their people. So keep my charge not to follow any of these abominable customs that others before you have followed, and thus you defile yourselves by doing them. I'm Adonai, your God. In verse 22, we get an explicit command against what in our day and age we call homosexuality. Now remember now, this particular admonition was directed to males. Male homosexuality is well attested to among the ancient Canaanites, even in non-biblical records. And God says that for a man to do such a thing is in Hebrew toevah, which is usually translated as an abomination, an aberrant. It is the strongest possible term to describe just how terrible of a transgression same-sex relations is to God. There have been found ancient depictions of Canaanite priests performing homosexual acts to their gods, and Jehovah made it abundantly clear his people aren't to do this. It's a perversion. And in Deuteronomy, the term Mehir Kelev is used to describe the wages, the monetary payment, usually paid to a homosexual prostitute. It translates to what is a Hebrew idiom, the wages of a dog. A dog was an idiom for a male homosexual prostitute. So there's no need for a Christian to be defensive about our stand, or at least what ought to be our stand about homosexuality. It's an abomination to God. It is stated directly as such here and in a number of places in the Old Testament and the New. Therefore, we cannot tolerate it in the body of Christ. We must not. We need to do all that we can to encourage the end of it in our society. Nobody's saying that if we have a gay daughter or son or a friend, we ought to stop loving them or ought to stop acknowledging them as human beings. All right. But love them by praying fervently for Jehovah to rescue them from such a destructive behavior. Don't ever excuse it as some kind of a new, modern, acceptable lifestyle. Don't ever make light of it. It's very serious. And finally, the commands on sexuality come to a conclusion with a prohibition against bestiality, sex between a human and an animal. I don't think I need to go into detail on this. What is interesting, though, is the reason put forth that this is so wrong in God's eyes. And it's one we've actually encountered before. It's wrong because it's an act of tevel, usually incorrectly translated as perversion. It means confusion. Confusion or improper mixing. Confusion and improper mixing is an offense to the Lord, and he commands against it. The idea is that it's a confusion to mix the species. It's improper mixing to mix a man and a beast. What is intended as good and proper sexual behavior within a species is to remain there. And confusion or improper mixing is the opposite of order and purity. Therefore, confusion is not something God's people, who are to emulate God as much as a human can, that we're to engage in. I should mention as well that this in no way is referring to a mixing of the human races. Never does the Bible deal with race, even though it does draw a distinction between Hebrews and Gentiles. Yet in reality, this is also not about race, because people of any race have always been perfectly welcome to join Israel. There's no restrictions. Rather, this is about mixing people with animals. Yet beyond mixing humans with animals, this command does have implications with mixing people within the human species. Let me be clear, though, in that the concern is about mixing unholy people with holy people. That's the concern. Or in the Old Testament context, the mixing of people of Israel with anybody else who's not and they don't want to be. Even then, however, this was never referring to racial or genealogical purity, ever. It was referring to people whose loyalties were to the God of Israel versus those who weren't. Because from the earliest times in the Bible, foreigners, people of other races, any and other, all races, were welcome to join Israel, welcome to marry racial, ethnic Hebrews. The caveat was they had to give up worship of their false gods and worship only the God of Israel. That was it. This chapter wraps up with the warning that you, meaning the Israelites, those foreigners among them, are not to do any of these prohibited sexual things, or what happened to the Egyptians and what's about to happen to the residents of the land of Canaan, that's going to be divinely visited upon Israel. This is not an idle warning. It's not hypothetical, and it's not symbolic. Verse 25, it says that the land becomes defiled by violating these laws on sexual behavior. We have seen in Leviticus a basic principle of uncleanness developed. It is that uncleanness can and is transmitted from people to inanimate objects and back again. Every one of the improper acts spoken of in Leviticus 18 creates ritual impurity, uncleanness in the violator. A sufficient number of these acts committed by a sufficient portion of the ruling population of a nation causes the land of that nation to become defiled, unclean, and as a result, God will take action and remove that people from that land as a judgment against them. Throughout the word, Yehovah makes it clear that the land and its inhabitants are intertwined. Being exiled out of one's land or having a nation's economy collapse or a nation experiencing a terrible series of natural disasters wreaking havoc on it are but a few of the ways that God will cause nature itself to come against the inhabitants of a land full of wicked people who've defiled their own land. And of course, there is some balance point at which some acts of rebellion against God become too much, and God takes action. We don't know exactly where that point is, but it exists. Listen to God's word to Abraham in Genesis. In Genesis 15, starting at verse 13. God said to Abraham, "Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that's not theirs. They will be enslaved and oppressed for 400 years. But I will also judge the nation whom they serve, and afterward they'll come out with many possessions. And as for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried at a good old age. Then in the fourth generation they shall return here, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete." Abraham was up in the land of Canaan when Yehovah spoke this to him. And God tells Abraham that many years into the future, his descendants are going to go from this land to another land, and there they're going to become enslaved. And then later they're going to come out and return to the land of Canaan. But what's the determining factor as to when that's going to happen? Look at the last half of verse 16. "For the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete or full." In other words, once the Amorites had reached some level of wickedness and evil, when child sacrificing and homosexuality and sexual immorality of all kinds and more had become sufficiently widespread and accepted by the Amorites, then God's going to act by bringing Abraham's descendants, the Israelites, back into the land where the Amorites live. And the Amorites are going to get cast out and the remainder subjugated by the Hebrews. Now, I hope you are as uneasy about this as I am. This is not just an ancient Bible story. This is how God operates. Every nation on earth that has reached some level of depravity that God determines is too much has been eventually terribly judged. Whether it's World War II Germany, or it's some of the Middle Eastern nations that have bedeviled Israel, or some currently godless European nations who are near financial collapse, the time will come when God takes action. How about America? How much longer will God allow our modern version of child sacrifice, abortion, to go on as acceptable national policy, desired national policy? How much longer will God allow homosexuality to be glorified to the point that some church denominations now openly market to gays and even ordain them as servants to God? How much longer will God allow a relatively few people on this planet to live in a place that calls having only one car and one color TV set poverty, while the majority of the planet goes to bed hungry? How much longer will God allow his removal from every government and public place and school and activity in our nation? I find it incredulous that the question you will see asked over and over now on television is, where was God when all those children were killed up in Connecticut? Nobody seems to have the courage to say, aren't you the same people that kicked God out of every school, kicked God out of every government branch, out of everything, and you don't want him anymore, and now you ask me, where was God? I don't know the answer to all these things, but I do know that if he will harshly judge his own set apart chosen people, those that he calls his precious treasure, he's certainly going to turn a blind eye to all the rest of us. Let's move on to chapter 19 rather, in Leviticus. Chapter 19, page 131, if you have a complete Jewish Bible. Adonai said to Moses, speak to the entire community of Israel and tell them, you people are to be holy because I, Adonai, your God, am holy. Every one of you is to revere his father and mother. You are to keep my Sabbaths, my Shabbats. I am Adonai, your God. Don't turn to idols. Don't cast metal gods for yourselves. I'm Adonai, your God. When you offer a sacrifice of peace offerings to Adonai, offer it in a way that will make you accepted. It is to be eaten the same day you offer it and the following day, but if any of it remains until the third, it's to be burned up completely. If any of it is eaten on the third day, it will have become a disgusting thing. It will not be accepted. Moreover, anyone who eats it will bear the consequences of profaning something holy meant for Adonai. That person will be cut off from his people. Let's stop there for a minute. This particular chapter of Leviticus is often set apart as something rather special by the Hebrews. It's a long chapter. It's often referred to as a Torah within a Torah. That is, chapter 19 is a kind of mini-Torah. It's a summation of the rules and the regulations that form the foundation for all the other rules and regulations of the law. Now, just as we're told that the commandment to love Yehovah with all your heart, mind, and soul, all your might, to love your neighbors as yourself, this is the basis upon which all the Torah commandments stand. Chapter 19 lays out what amounts to a definition of what we ought to be very concerned about. It gives us a definition of what it means to be holy. What holy life looks like for one of God's people. I think that's something we ought to know. And indeed, we will find direct reference to at least six of the Ten Commandments and indirect reference to the other four. Those six commandments begin with the one that is omitted in almost all Christian Bible canon. I am Jehovah your God. It surprises most people to know that I am Jehovah your God was the original first commandment. If you remember back many months ago to our lesson on Exodus 20 and the Ten Commandments, I told you that the earliest Hebrew manuscripts discovered actually number the Ten Commandments, just as our modern Bibles do. But whereas our Christian Ten Commandments always begin with, "You will have no other gods before me," as the first commandment, in fact, the original scriptures make, "I am Jehovah your God," the first commandment, "and you are to have no other gods," as the second commandment. Sometime in the 4th or 5th century AD, the Roman Church decided to abolish the first commandment. But since the Bible clearly states that there are 10, there's not 9 commandments, the Roman Church authorities solved the problem by splitting the original second commandment into 2 commandments. The first one, "You are to have no other gods." The second, "You are not to make a graven image." The other 5 commandments directly referred to in Leviticus 19 are the second, "No other gods." The third, "No false oaths." The fourth, "Observe the Shabbat," the Sabbath. The fifth, "Honor your parents." And the eighth, "Don't steal." Here's the thing. It was a sad day in Christianity when the changeover from Jewish leadership to Gentile leadership of the church became complete. Because at that moment, those things about Scripture that felt comfortable and familiar to the Gentile world became dominant. And those things about Scripture which were overtly Jewish and therefore uncomfortable and unfamiliar to the Gentile world, those were set aside. And among those Jewish things set aside was the entire Torah. And with it went the proper context for all that was going to follow it in the Bible. Holiness and its supreme importance for believers, and what God's definition of holiness is, all that was set aside. Now we make it up. So as we study Leviticus 19, let us pray that God will put the admonitions contained within this chapter deep into our hearts, and that He will show us how to reapply instead of reinterpreting these divine ordinances in our 21st century Western culture. Because indeed, what does He say? We are to be holy because He is holy. So let's finish reading out now chapter 19. I finished off at verse 7, we start at verse 8. Verse 8, start at verse 9. "For when you harvest the ripe crops produced in your land, don't harvest all the way to the corners of your field. Don't gather the ears of grain left by the harvesters. Right. Likewise, don't gather the grapes left on the vine or fallen on the ground after harvest. Leave them for the poor and for the foreigner. I'm Adonai your God. Do not steal from, defraud, or lie to each other. Do not swear by my name falsely, which would be profaning the name of your God. I'm Adonai. Do not oppress or rob your neighbor. Specifically, you're not to keep back the wages of a hired worker all night until morning. Do not speak a curse against a deaf person or place an obstacle in the way of a blind person. Rather, fear your God. I am Adonai. Do not be unjust in judging. Show neither partiality to the poor nor deference to the mighty, but with justice judge your neighbor. Don't go around spreading slander among your people, but also don't stand idly by when your neighbor's life is at stake. I am Adonai. Don't hate your brother in your heart, but rebuke your neighbor frankly, so that you won't carry sin because of him. Don't take vengeance on or bear a grudge against any of your people. Rather, love your neighbor as yourself. I'm Adonai. Observe my regulations. Don't let your livestock mate with those of another kind. Don't sow your field with two different kinds of grain. Don't wear a garment of cloth made with two different kinds of thread. If a man has sexual relations with a woman who is a slave intended for another man, and she has neither been redeemed nor given her freedom, there is to be an investigation. They are not to be put to death because she was not free. In a reparation, he is to bring a ram as a guilt offering for himself to the entrance of the tent of meeting. The priest will make atonement for him with the ram of the guilt offering before Adonai for the sin he's committed. He will be forgiven for the sin he committed. When you enter the land and plant various kinds of fruit trees, you are to regard its fruit as forbidden. For 3 years it will be forbidden to you and not eaten. In its fourth year, all its fruit will be holy for praising Adonai. In its fifth year, you may eat its fruit, so that it will produce even more for you. I am Adonai, your God. Do not eat anything with blood. Do not practice divination or fortune telling. Don't round your hair at the temples or mar the edges of your beard. Don't cut gashes in your flesh when someone dies or tattoo yourselves, I am Adonai. Do not debase your daughter by making her a prostitute so that the land won't fall into prostitution and become full of shame. Keep my Sabbaths. Revere my sanctuary. I am Adonai. Do not turn to spirit mediums or sorcerers. Don't seek them out to be defiled by them. I am Adonai, your God. Stand up in the presence of a person with gray hair. Show respect for the old. You are to fear your God. I am Adonai. If a foreigner stays with you in your land, do not do him wrong. Treat the foreigner staying with you like the native born among you. You are to love him as yourself, for you were foreigners in the land of Egypt. I am Adonai, your God. Don't be dishonest when measuring length, weight, or capacity. Rather, use an honest balance scale, honest weights, an honest bushel dry measure, and an honest gallon liquid measure. I am Adonai, your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt. Observe all my regulations and rulings and do them. I am Adonai. Chapter 19 is the general definition of how holiness should be manifested in the life of a person set apart for holiness. In the Old Testament, those persons were Israel. In the New Testament, those persons are those who have come into union with Messiah Yeshua. Now, we can have legitimate arguments, debates, over whether or not we're to follow to the letter, in the same kind of cultural setting, all of the 613 laws and regulations set before us in the Torah. But what is not arguable is that the principle and pattern of what was holy in 1300 or 1400 BC when the Torah was first given to Moses is the same as it is today. Holiness has not changed. I want to quote for you a brief passage of an essay written by Joseph Hertz, who was the chief rabbi of the United Hebrew Congregations during the time leading up to and during World War II. And he says this about Leviticus 19 in general, about holiness specifically. He says this: developing the idea of holiness as order and not confusion. This list, the verses of Leviticus 19, upholds rectitude and straight dealing as holy, and contradiction and double dealing as against holiness. Theft, lying, false witness, cheating in weights and measures, all kinds of dissembling, such as speaking ill of the deaf and presumably smiling to their faces, hating your brother in your heart while speaking kindly to him. These are clearly contradictions between what seems and what is. Or as Professor Gordon Wenham says, holiness is expressed in moral integrity, which in turn is expressed by physical wholeness. Let me put it to you another way. Don't talk to me about the Holy One, Yeshua, living in your heart at the same moment you're denying the need to live a holy life. Don't tell me you can have the Spirit of God dwelling in you, but you see no obedience, no need to be obedient to Him, to show any obedience to Him at all. That obedience is a thing of the past. And what is God's Torah but the spelling out of what we call morality. Morality is what is good, separated from everything that's not. I'm not saying that we are necessarily to act out these laws established in the ancient Middle Eastern cultural context in exactly the same way they were acted out 3,000 years ago. But some things should be, and other things can be brought forward as intact as possible, the biblical feast, for example. But the definition of what is moral, what is not, was set down by God. It doesn't matter about inherent cultural barriers, and so these principles shouldn't be altered by man. It's interesting that Rabbi Hertz sees one of the primary defining attributes of holiness as order. Again, as defined by God, not by man. As opposed to chaos, confusion. Because last week, when we were looking at the first part of Leviticus 18, we saw that the sin of bestiality, having sex with humans, was wrong because it was tevel. It was an act of confusion, of improper mixing. We're going to stop and look at a couple of instances in Leviticus 19 where confusion is the issue. And it takes on some very interesting and, I think, quite profound applications. After this introduction to Leviticus 19 and after the general command to be holy because I'm holy, we get reminded of two of the Ten Commandments of Mount Sinai. In verse 4, Israel is told they shall revere their father and mother and they shall keep my Sabbaths. What is it about one's father and mother that's so important to God? They gave you life, at least in a physical sense. They were given the responsibility to be an authority over you in order to train you up. From a spiritual viewpoint, it's similar to our relationship with Jehovah. He gave us life. So we are to recognize his authority over us. This is the reality of duality in action once again. This principle is true in both the physical realm and in the spiritual realm simultaneously. And of course, here we find another reference to Sabbath observance, put front and center. Keeping the Sabbath was a key part of God's plan for those who trust him. Not as part of salvation, but as obedience. As with anything God ordains, Sabbath could be made into a burden and into a works-based legal exercise. And in fact, Sabbath did become one of the most argued points of contention among the Jews. Not whether or not it ought to be observed, not even when it ought to be observed. Rather, the disagreements were over the details of how to properly observe Sabbath. I'm not going to get into a spiel with you today about Shabbat being the seventh day of the week and only the seventh day, Saturday in our modern terminology, even though it's so. What I want to point out is that Sabbath is one of those moral choices that God lays out for us. If you attended my lesson in Genesis 6, we explored the source of evil and why and how it exists. If you did, then the idea of Sabbath being a moral choice is a lot easier to grasp. For those who didn't hear it, it might be good if you obtained the CD or listened to it on our website. But in a nutshell, the concept is that our will is that part of us that's put there by God for the purpose of making moral choices. That's the point of our will. Will is not about preferences, ice cream flavors, your favorite deodorant soap. God allows men many preferences that are inherently neither right nor wrong, but the choice of the will is always about right and wrong, good and evil, obedience or disobedience. In the same way, Sabbath is not about preference. How one observes Sabbath, exactly what you eat, what you wear, how you observe it, do you light candles, what prayers do you recite during it, these things are a matter of preference. As it's made clear by Paul in Colossians 2:16, let no one disquiet you about food and drink, distinctions of festivals, new moon, Sabbaths. God's Sabbaths and his new moons were no more abolished than were food and drink. So along with Sabbath, what we should begin to ponder is this. Since our wills make moral choices, therefore the choice is always for God or against God. And since God makes clear just what defines for God and against God, that indeed disobedience amounts to nothing less than a moral choice of our wills to go against God. That's what disobedience is. But also notice that there is some kind of connection made between honoring one's parents and Sabbath keeping. Not only are they the first things mentioned after the instruction to be holy as Yehovah is holy, but it's in the same sentence and they're connected. This did not escape the eye of the great rabbis, because this particular sentence structure is intended to show there is a linkage between these two commandments. It was demonstrating that even as honoring our parents stands as a priority number one among human duties, humans to human interaction, the very first step among our duties to God and therefore towards becoming holy is to sanctify and observe the Sabbath in our lives. That's our number one duty. We have to set it apart in our lives just as God sanctified the seventh day Shabbat at the beginning of the world. That's why they're linked. We're going to continue chapter 19 the next time we meet.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.